A 28-gun frigate of His Majesty's Navy was a ship of about 500 tons, with a deck length of 110 feet or so, not including the bowsprit, and a beam of just over 30 feet. The guns would have been 9-pounders, 14 to a side, giving her a broadside weight, the massive cannonballs she could discharge in one broadside, of 126 pounds. She would carry a crew of over 200 men with 18 officers, including two lieutenants, a sailing master, gunner, boatswain, carpenter, surgeon and four midshipmen. Collingwood was one of these last, the lowest form of life aboard a ship, and frequently reminded of it, even though he had the right to report for punishment seamen of vast experience three times his age. Very quickly, Collingwood had to learn the ropes, 30 miles of them. Futtock shrouds, tacks, bowlines, sheets, cross-catharpins, backstays, forestays, shrouds, ratlines and many more, often with archaic and sometimes silly-sounding names like Timenagy. There were masts and sails to comprehend, mizzen, main and fore, topmasts, topgallant masts, courses, spritsails, skyscrapers, bonnets, stunsails and staysails. In almost any manoeuvre at sea, complicated combinations of all these things had to be controlled with perfection. The midshipman's berth was cramped, dark, revoltingly smelly and fetid, running with a combination of water, general filth and rats. On long voyages, midshipmen would hunt them down and eat them as food supplies ran low. Midshipmen were the future officers of the Royal Navy, and in addition to their duties in charge of the seamen, were expected to learn to steer and sail a ship, take navigational readings, survey ports and harbours and handle guns, so that eventually they might pass for lieutenant. Collingwood later became as famous for his educating and handling of midshipmen as he was for his many other qualities. In optimal conditions, frigates, lightly armed and built for speed, could make something over 10 or 12 knots, about 11 to 14 miles per hour. They were comparatively manoeuvrable, but even so they could not point closer to the wind than 67 degrees. If you imagine a clock, you want to go towards the 12, but cannot aim closer than 2 or 10 o'clock, which meant that sailing upwind involved endless tacking, zigzagging in a slow and cumbersome slalom motion. A man of war had to carry enough men to sail the ship under any set of possible conditions, and to fight her at the same time. Each gun required a crew of 6 to 8 men to fire, clean and reload it, and with a gun, even a small frigate's 9-pounder, weighing 1.5 tons, and with an awesome recoil, the men had to be either very experienced or learn very fast. In a heavy sea, guns, when out of control, could smash through a ship's side, and injuries were frequent, caused by crushing, exploding barrels and enemy fire. Splinters were perhaps the worst, much like shrapnel from a bomb. The job of a midshipman like Collingwood, in action, would be to look after the crews of several guns, ensuring they had enough powder and shot, and redistribute them when men were injured or killed, or when guns were put out of action. The diet of a seaman in the Georgian Navy was notorious. Biscuit as hard as rock and full of weevils, bitter to the taste, or grubs, cold on the tongue. Salt meat that was often so old and hard that spare parts for the ship could be fashioned from it. Water that was rank after a few weeks at sea, and cheese that was so putrid only rats would touch it. All these things are true, but they're not the whole story. For one thing, the sailor's diet has to be compared with that available to landsmen. It may have been less fresh, but in quantity it was generous, 6 pounds of meat per week, for example, to each man. When in foreign waters, the diet would often be supplemented with fresh fish and local fruit and vegetables, and although the beer and rum issue was enough to ensure a state of semi-permanent drunkenness, it was laced with lime to help prevent scurvy, and almost all captains of Collingwood's day realised the importance of diet in maintaining the health of their crews. Whether a young midshipman like Collingwood thrived or not depended on many things. His character, his messmates, the captain and officers under whom he served, and perhaps above all, on luck. Many couldn't take it. Many more were simply unfit for its hardships. Collingwood was lucky in one sense. Braithwaite, his commander, was capable and decent, and ensured that he learnt the ways of the ship without undue humiliation, lessons that he himself would pass on. A midshipman could not be considered for his first crucial promotion to lieutenant until he had been at sea 6 years, at least. Then he had to pass a severe examination at the Admiralty, and very often in that age he had to pass for a gentleman, too. Commanders like James Cook, another northeasterner, were a rarity in having, as Collingwood himself approvingly put it, come through the porthole rather than the cabin window. We know little about Collingwood's career in these early years. What we do know is that he was conscientious and proved himself a highly capable seaman. Between 1761 and 1773, he served in at least 5 ships. Shannon, the frigates Gibraltar and Liverpool, in which he kept a log that survives. Lennox, a much larger ship of 70 guns, and Portland, a fourth-rate two-decker of 50 guns, from whose voyage we have another log. Shannon was mainly employed in home and Atlantic waters, though once the war ended there was little chance of any action in her. In Gibraltar, also commanded by Braithwaite, Collingwood made his first trip to the Mediterranean. In the Liverpool he made the first of many visits to Port Mahon on the southeast coast of Minorca. The British possessed Minorca for much of the 18th century. It was and is one of the finest natural harbours in the Mediterranean, long and sheltered and very deep, 100 feet or so, right up to the quayside. On this commission, having been promoted to the rank of master's mate, he completed a survey of the harbour. In the Portland, in 1773, Collingwood made his first journey to the West Indies. This station was notorious in the service, mainly because of the climate. Malaria and yellow fever were rife, but partly because of that, and the high incidence of piracy, a young sailor had a better chance of promotion here than on any other station. No such luck for Collingwood, though. Intriguingly, he later recalled that this was the year he met Nelson, and in which they began an extraordinary friendship that would last 32 years. While Collingwood languished in dull and dangerous service, the world was moving on. At Newcastle, that winter of 1773, the River Tyne froze 4 miles below the bridge. It was a new bridge. All the others, including the medieval Tyne Bridge with its famous houses, had been swept away a year before in a terrible flood, and a skating match took place on it. Mozart, aged 8, had already performed before the young King George III. HMS Victory had been launched, and James Watt had patented his new steam engine. There was peace of sorts in Europe. But in 1773 rumblings of discontent in the colonies across the Atlantic were already making ripples at home. This was the year of the Boston Tea Party, when a dispute about unfair import duties culminated in a group of young men dressed up as native Indians tossing a load of British tea into Boston Harbour. By the end of the year, the British Army garrison and Loyalist inhabitants of the city were virtually under siege, and dependent on the Navy to supply them. As a result, Collingwood finally got his chance for a slice of glory, not at sea, but in a land battle. He was to be a first-hand witness of, and participant in, the American War of Independence. There were enlightened men, as well as interested money-makers, on both sides of the Atlantic, who deplored the breach between Britain and the New World. But George III was implacable. In May 1774, the Boston and Country Gazette, a so-called rebel newspaper, reported news from London that a Boston port bill was to be passed, blockading all trade from that city. The editor wrote, "Concerning public matters, I'm sorry to say that things are going from bad to worse, and a breach between Great Britain and her colonies seems approaching very fast. This accursed tea is the very match that is appointed to set fire to a train of gunpowder." And so it proved. By the end of 1773, British and Loyalist Bostonians were virtually besieged in the city's peninsula. Before massive later land clearance, it was connected to the mainland by a narrow spit of low-lying land. The standoff only entrenched more deeply the stubborn attitudes of both sides. The train of gunpowder, once lit, would lead to independence for the colonies from Great Britain after a bitter 8-year war.